Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Men's semi-finals decided. We will be having Juan Martín Del Potro in his first US Open final, his first Grand Slam final since 2009, up against Novak Djokovic in the final on Sunday. You join Simon Briggs from The Telegraph and myself, David Law, on the media bus about to pull away from Flushing Meadows, and Catherine Whittaker will be with us fairly soon in the second part of the podcast. But Simon, I want to get your thoughts on what we've seen tonight. It's been a bit underwhelming, I think it's fair to say.
Well, yes, we had a retirement in the first match after two sets. Rafa was clearly very upset, as you would expect. It's the second time this season he's had to abandon a slam match after the quarterfinal of the Australian Open. I guess the two hard court slams, maybe there's not a coincidence there. And then Novak gave Nishikori a bit of a schooling. It was a high quality match, but one that lacked a little bit of dramatic texture because Djokovic came out so strong, and you just never thought that he was going to be in trouble, and indeed he wasn't.
No, he wasn't. And the shame of it all, and the slightly weird feeling of it all, is that when Del Potro and Nadal first got out there, I mean, the intensity was so extreme, even before they struck a ball, the way they came out like heavyweight boxers, and they were jumping around like jack-in-the-boxes out there, you know, just straining to get at each other. And the first sort of five games were fantastic. The first set was a tiebreak. It was more than an hour long, and yet Nadal said afterwards that he felt something go at 2-2 in the first set. And I mean, he was absolutely devastated. You could see it in his face throughout that. Certainly throughout the early stages of the second set, he tried everything, didn't he, in that first set. He managed to claw a break back, got himself into the tie break, but, you know, he was not even competitive in the second set.
Yeah, he said later that it wasn't a tennis match by the end. It was one guy playing tennis and the other guy just staying on the other side of the net. It was just too painful to continue. He's retired in three slam matches only, two of them this year. The first one was, apparently it was the same day 10 years ago at the US Open when Andy Murray was playing him in the semi-final. Was that Andy's first...
First Grand Slam final.
First Grand Slam final, so it sort of echoes there. But, you know, he looked a little bit concerned. He said it was more of an aggressive pain than he was used to in his knee, because normally it's a progressive one. This one he actually felt go in a little bit of a sharp way. But then he said, look, I still think it's basically the same thing. You know, it's not going to be a six-month injury. I don't think I'm just going to have to work through it like I've done in the past, you know, a few weeks of rehab and get back on the court.
One of the things that really struck me was, I think maybe his last answer, or his last but one answer in that press conference, when he explained that he was asked about the comparisons between what Federer and Djokovic have gone through with their injuries recently, you know, and he was quite miffed at that, and he made the point, well, hold on, they haven't had anything like injuries that I've had over the years. I've missed so many slams, you know, that I thought you got a real insight into how his mind worked in that answer, that it was kind of like, I've done all this in spite of my injuries.
Yeah, like imagine how many slams I would have if my body hadn't betrayed me. I guess people would always have said, I mean, he admitted that there's always been a concern about his style of play, and he said, nobody in this room, and I include myself in that, would have imagined I would be here at 32, playing for big titles, number one in the world. So that was a sort of an acknowledgement that there is something in the theory that his hell for leather, dueling, kind of never give up, never say die approach does take it out of him. The knees have obviously been the biggest issue, but of course, when you read his autobiography, there was the whole period with the strange bone in his foot that never developed, wasn't there, which he has to have special shoes developed for, and who knows how much that has sort of set off a chain reaction that's gone up his body.
One man that he certainly can't outdo in terms of injury woe is the man that beat him today, Juan Martin Del Potro. Would you say, I mean, I certainly feel as though I thought this would never happen if we were to go back, say, 2-3 years. Del Potro would effectively have said the same thing in his post-match interview, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me in the first set was the way that he was hitting his backhand. There was an early point, wasn't there, when Rafa came in to the Del Potro double-hander, which would have been a bankable tactic a couple of years ago, because he wouldn't be able to do anything but slice. But this time he just walloped it up the line with 80 or 90 mile an hour sort of speed on the ball, and it was just coming off both wings with almost equal ferocity. Well, not, that's not quite true, is it? But only the only reason that's not quite true is because the forehand is so absurdly huge, and the backhand was still big and strong and powerful, and was winning points cleanly as well before Rafa started to seize up. So that's a massive bonus for Del Potro. He's almost developed the rest of his game to cover for that weakness, and now he's got that back, and the rest of his game's come on. He's a better player than he's ever been, but having said that, he's got to play Novak in the next round.
And the record is, I think, 14 wins for Djokovic, 4 defeats. 4 wins for Del Potro. He beat him at the Olympics, didn't he, a couple of years ago? First round, 7-6, 7-6. He's had other wins. He had that... I'm trying to think what other wins he's had against Djokovic. I saw them earlier, but, I mean, he was beaten in 5 sets.
One of them in Indian Wells?
Yeah, oh, actually, and that was an amazing match. Something like 4-6, 6-4, 6-4. Brilliant match. There was the win for Djokovic in 5 sets at Wimbledon in the semi-finals, the year that Andy Murray won Wimbledon and beat Djokovic in the final. How do you think that they measure up, those two? Because you're quite right. I thought Djokovic looked tonight as good as he's ever looked to me.
Yeah, you feel like you could probably wrap all the other players into a composite and send them out to face Novak, and he'd probably gun them down. The way he's playing, it feels like a final where you'll go in hoping for a great match but not expecting one, because his level's been just so outrageous. And the other factor might be the crowd, because the noise for Del Potro tonight was incredible. He had his own cheer squad in the deck just above me in the stadium on the balcony there, but then on the upper bowl there was a chant going on from the cheer squad, and then there was they were going ole ole Del Po, and then there was the long kind of Del Po simultaneously, so the two sort of rhythms like a kind of piece of modernist music simultaneously during some of the changeovers in the first set before the match began to lose some of its edge, and that was incredible. I mean, I remember Roger playing Novak here in the final 3 years ago, was it? And it was,
yeah,
probably the most one-sided crowd you can remember, but even then they weren't chanting in quite the way that they were tonight. So that happens in the final, well, it's going to be a great atmosphere, but it might just perk Novak up even more. His performances this year, when people have been giving him a bit of jip in the crowd, have been even better than the rest of his performances.
Well, there was the moment tonight when Nishikori started to make it competitive in the second set, and at the start of it he played some fabulous stuff, and Djokovic was just fighting it off. He was just having none of it. Didn't matter how hard Nishikori hit the ball at him, it was coming back with interest. He was sliding into the ball and all this stuff, and then, but it was close, and at 2-1 Djokovic serving, he missed a first serve, and some people in the crowd applauded his fault, and he just looked up at them and he just sort of smirked as if to say, yeah, classy and get lost. And then he went and just started winning again. And I thought, that is the old Djokovic, just not having it. You know, not going to pretend it's not happening. He's gonna let you know he's heard you, and yet he's going to sort you out as a result of it. I mean, I thought that was great. And then when he went two sets up, he'd been so quiet all the way through the match, and then suddenly he just exploded with emotion.
Actually, it puts one in mind of the great Jonathan Overendlander, doesn't it, during that rare victory for Murray over Novak at Wimbledon in, is it 2013? And Jonathan said when Novak began to come back from the dead at the very end, he didn't quite make it back from the dead, but he looked like he might, and Jonathan said he's stroking his white cat like a Bond villain.
he does occupy that territory, even though I don't think he sets out to, but he has that defiance in him, doesn't he? And he's quite, if you're going to come for him, he's going to be there to meet you head on.
I guess as soon as I arrived here and I heard the tournament saying that they'd slowed down the courts, he thought, well, that's going to be music to Novak's ears. He's clearly the greatest defender the game's ever seen. His movement is off the charts. He's got that kind of bounce back in him, in his legs. He just seems to soak up the impact. So has he dropped a set? Has he dropped one set? Dropped
one set, hasn't he? Yeah, on the way to this point. Against Tennis Sangren, actually, yeah.
Right. But otherwise, I mean, it's been a struggle for the rest of them. Novak's had a couple of moments in the heat when he's called the doctor for a pill, and I'm guessing it's an anti-nausea pill, and he did talk about the difficulty of breathing at the bottom, but he's never really seemed to be in much danger, has he, compared to the rest of them who've really been struggling. Remember Del Potro deliberately leaving balls to go past in his quarterfinal against John Isner because he was conserving energy for his own service games. So Djokovic being the one person who's, even in conditions which he traditionally has struggled with, has just sailed on regardless. It just seems untouchable, really. I mean, it felt a little bit written when we arrived, as I say, and heard about the court change, and then just seems to be going according to the script.
Another retirement for Nadal, a couple of them this year. It led to immediate Twitter avalanche about best of five sets from our good friend Ben Rothenberg. And for somebody who doesn't use Twitter that much, I suddenly noticed you becoming very active, Simon. So where do you stand on all this now?
I'm not convinced about best of three in Grand Slam, but I just wanted to point out that you've got to accept a pattern exists. Because if you think about late matches, showpiece matches, big ticket matches at Slams this year, and even going back into last year, a lot of them have been affected by players running out of gas. So obviously Rafa twice this year, Kyle Edmund in Australia, Del Potro in Paris, the final of Wimbledon. The final of Wimbledon last year, that was a blister. I mean, it's a little bit different, but it's still a workload issue. It's just there is a pattern, and what cannot be forgotten is that the game gets more physical every year. The players get better and deeper, and then tournaments like the US Open then make the decision to slow the course down. And then we've had hotter weather everywhere we've gone this year, and it's all building up to make it pretty tough. And fine, you know, gladiators, guys who train incredibly hard, athletes, the ultimate test, so on and so on. But at the point when you're actually getting showpiece matches which are not delivering, and you're getting flat days at the end of tournaments, that's the point at which you just have to accept there's a pattern, and you've got to start a debate. It doesn't mean that you're going to get rid of best of five sets. I'm not saying that. They're saying that if people are not acknowledging there's a pattern, then they're deluding themselves.
No, I accept the pattern, certainly. One thing I would say, though, is the guys that have dominated this sport for the last 15 years, more in Federer's case, they're still there in their 30s, mid-30s. You know, 31, Murray and Djokovic, 32, Nadal, 33, Wawrinka, 37, Federer. If five set collapse was so damaging, how would they still be doing this after all that time, in arguably the greatest era we've ever had?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we may have lost the British member of that contingent for the moment, haven't we? He played a couple of matches here, Andy Murray, but workload appears to have got to him quite significantly.
Not done yet.
No, but slowing down and looking for a different way of going about his tennis business from here on in.
Lots of players that have been retired at 31 in the past.
I mean, my argument was less about probably the players. I mean, there is a health factor there, but maybe more about tournaments and what it does to a tournament when you may not be talking about lengthy issues. I mean, a blister was one of the issues I mentioned. Del Potro had some sort of groin thing in Paris, didn't he? Kevin Anderson was purely fatigued at Wimbledon. So those things are things you can recover from. But I'm more talking about the effect of matches on the biggest stages, which are affected by workload in that tournament.
So what do you think of my idea of having the first four rounds, three sets, for both men and women, and then switching both to best of five sets for the sort of showpiece matches, so that you really give those a bit of elevation, and but you're preserving players in the first week, and then maybe they've got more left in the tank?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possible option. The only thing that strikes me is that the system would lend itself to supporting the established order, because anyone coming in for the first time who breaks into a second week will have a disadvantage against a regular second weeker, because best of five sets is something that, I mean, some players adjust to it faster than others, but there's quite a few guys. You look at Zverev, maybe Kyle Edmund took a while to get the hang of it. It's not something that you necessarily adapt to quickly, so that's one concern.
Interesting. Yeah, just a final thought going into the weekend now, how does your story layout look and your priority order look here, you know, in terms of what is the priority? We've got Serena Williams against Naomi Osaka tomorrow, we've got Del Potro against Djokovic in the men's final. What are the stories for you?
Well, it's just Jamie Murray is the other one that we need to mention, isn't it?
Yeah, he's in the mixed doubles final tomorrow at 5 p.m. UK time. I'm just curious as sort of, you know, what is the best story left here for you as a journalist?
Well, I guess the women's final, on the face of it, is a more appetizing match than the men's, unless Del Potro makes it closer than I'm expecting. If Del Potro can do a Wawrinka, and you know, Wawrinka's twice taken Djokovic down in these massive matches by overpowering him, Del Potro has the same firepower, so he could do that. On the face of it, I would have thought that the Serena Osaka match has got more plot lines and a better chance of being a ripper. We've got a couple of previews in the paper coming up from Greg Wozzecki. He's written a piece in tomorrow's paper about the women's final. He's going to do the men's final, and yeah, obviously mixed doubles are going to get a look in. And why has this bus not moved?
Yeah, I tell you, we're just sitting here. Basically, these buses are supposed to go every half an hour, but Simon Briggs and myself, we've been here for now 17 minutes and 32 seconds talking to you here on the Tennis Podcast, but it's a good opportunity to have done so. We're now going to get back to Manhattan and go home. I'm going to go and get a beer with Catherine to finish off the pod. But yeah, just as a very final point, Serena Williams trying for her 24th Grand Slam singles title, Naomi Osaka for her first. In a way, they're both quite good stories, though, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. It's extraordinary in a number of ways, not least because of the sort of way that the Osaka sisters parallel the Williams sisters. There's an 18-month age gap between them. Their father, Francois, tried to bring them up in deliberate imitation of the Richard Williams method. And when Osaka was asked who her idols were, she said, my mum, Serena, and Beyonce.
Brilliant. Hey, listen to that. Round of applause inside the bus, and the reason is because it's moving. See you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So from the media bus with Simon Briggs of The Telegraph to Catherine Whittaker in the lobby, sitting with champagne here as we look back on day 12 of the US Open, in which Catherine's been presenting for Amazon Prime Video UK, the home of the US Open in the UK, our partners over this period. And Catherine, very nice of you to have got champagne out for my birthday. How nice.
And cake, no less. Yeah. Any excuse for champagne and cake, frankly, on day 12 of a Grand Slam. But your birthday is just that.
I've got a beer. I've got a champagne glass.
Well, I didn't know if you... My dad always does that annoying thing where he says yes to a glass of champagne just to join in, but doesn't actually like it very much.
Right.
So it's like you're sort of looking at him going, that's just a waste of a glass of champagne, Dad.
Right, well, okay.
I got your backup beer.
You're not drinking mine, I'm telling you that.
But you do really seem to enjoy it, so that's fine. As long as you're enjoying it, that's fine.
I'm delighted with both, so that's fine. So
two different drinks lore. It's not as catchy, is it?
But Simon Briggs and I have been through the various stories of the day on the whole, but we want to have your flavour of what's gone on. What did you think of it all?
Well, let's be honest, match-wise, entertainment-wise, drama-wise, it was all very disappointing. I'm desperately sorry for Nadal. Desperately. I mean, he was inconsolable in that press conference, wasn't he?
And looked pretty depressed during the match, that second set.
He
was so gutted. He was on the verge of tears.
That's two Grand Slams that the greatest competitive animal the sport has ever seen has had to retire from in a year. Two Grand Slam semi-finals. I mean, that'll just kill him.
You had one of them in your studio in Jimmy Connors. I mean, it must be so hard for these people to accept.
Yeah. There were many things that Jimmy Connors said today in the studio that were... I mean, he was basically, like, springing out of his chair, sort of wanting to jump into the television monitor in our street. He wanted to be out there himself so much. He could barely contain himself. And you know, I asked him, is there anything... Is a tiny part of the reason that these guys, these legends, are still out here doing what they're doing at their ages? And okay, Nadal's only 32, but you know what I mean. Is it a slight fear of retirement and not being able to find anything to replace... And he said, well, I've never found anything to remotely replace the feeling of walking out onto the stage for Grand Slam semi-finals. And there was a real, like, sort of harrowing look in his eye. You know, he said, it's not that I've not been happy. I've had a family and it's all been great, but nothing's ever replaced that. And I think about it every day.
Yeah.
And Nadal is the one I worry for the most. You know, Federer will go and be a CEO of something, Djokovic will be a politician, Murray will be a coach or an analyst, or a campaigner or something, what's Nadal going to do? Is he going to fish?
Well, I mean, I think he'll have things that he feels very passionate about, like his academy. I could see him doing things like that.
But day to day, you know, what's going to occupy him day to day? Because he's not going to day to day be at a desk in a suit in at his academy, is he? Yes, he's obviously completely committed to it. Great, but he's not going to do that.
I think he will coach, you know.
I think
because then he could channel himself. Look how he was at the Laver Cup last year.
Yeah.
So I think he's the perfect Davis Cup captain, really.
Yes.
If you think of that image of him in the Laver Cup, I think he's that kind of person. He needs something. You could imagine him as a football analogy, he's a football manager.
Did Spain support the changes? They did, didn't they? No.
I can't remember now. I think they did. I can't remember. But anyway, I could see him doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's...
I just got a sort of glimpse of Nadal without the adrenaline of competition coursing through his veins in that press conference, and it was a bleak, bleak place.
Yeah, because he was so torn, wasn't he, in that match? Do I retire? Don't I retire? I'm not somebody who retires. This isn't me. I don't do this. But yeah, I've got to retire.
Yeah. He must have been in agony. I can only assume he was in agony. And the other thing I have to say is I really, really felt for Dominic Thiem. I really did, because that Thiem Nadal match was one where I don't care who won the last point. Thiem deserved to go through as well, really. And the fact that, you know, what I know that's just how it works, but what agony for him.
Yeah, and it's not Nadal's fault. I mean,
of course it's not.
He came bouncing out the traps like
nobody's
business. Of course
it's not. I'm not suggesting that for a moment, but it's just tough for him, isn't it? It's a tough one to take. That, you know, that competitive place in the semi-final, that, you know, Nadal wasn't in a position to fulfil the opportunity today. Mm. So that opportunity just didn't exist. It's not like the opportunity then goes to the next best placed person.
No.
But it's okay, because he's posted a video, a photo on Instagram. He's already back home with his lovely Labrador. So most of my sympathy has evaporated, because... I mean, I'd quite like to be with his lovely Labrador.
Labrador MD.
Great, yeah. Right. So, the only better place than being in a Grand Slam semi-final is by the side of a Labrador.
Yeah, or sitting with champagne having a chat with me
on
the podcast.
but, and that wonderful embrace between them, between Nadal and Del Potro. I mean, I'm sure you and Simon covered that.
Not the end of the match, because that was the one interesting thing, is Del Potro slightly got lost in all this, because it was all about Nadal at that moment, wasn't it?
And I'm completely imposing my own script on this, but I like to think that what Nadal was saying to him in those moments was that it's kind of okay to feel good about this. You know, you deserve this, regardless of how this particular moment has unfolded. You deserve to be in this final,
right,
and you should enjoy it.
That's what he was saying.
Yeah, let's just decide that that is what he said, because
it's a lovely ending to the film, isn't it?
Isn't it? And if that is what he said, then he's absolutely right.
Yeah, it is. So we've got Del Potro in the final. Simon reckons he's going to get overwhelming support in the final against Djokovic.
He is.
And Simon also thinks that will make Djokovic even more dangerous. If one thinks back to 3 years ago and that
I
final.
I think it'll make both of them more dangerous.
Mm. Oh, we're going to get an absolute storm.
You're right, though. I mean, you often cite that Djokovic-Federer final here 3 years ago is sort of the worst example of a partisan crowd, or the worst manifestation of a partisan crowd that you can remember. I don't think it'll be like that.
No.
Because
it'll be more just joyous.
Yes, it'll be more jubilant, I think. And I think possibly Djokovic will be more accepting of it.
I don't know about that. My sense is that he's just now in that zone of competitiveness now, which is, look, it's fine to support the guy, that's fine, but don't go putting me off, because if you do, I'm just going to be better.
Will, though. Do you think they will? Del Potro fans seem quite well behaved, really.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they are quite well behaved, but and sometimes it's just the exuberance, isn't it? The determination that their man will win.
That day with Federer and Djokovic, remember, there'd been like a 4-hour rain delay and everyone had had to wait. There was no roof. That was the last year with no roof. It was all, I don't know, it was a perfect storm to create a sort of a cauldron.
Plus, it was the way the thing was going. Djokovic was dominant, really. And then Federer managed to start coming back at him when it seemed all was lost. And then you sort of got this build-up of emotion.
Yeah, so we got not only the Federer support, he also got the underdog support.
Yeah, and the neutrals.
So, exactly, a perfect storm. So I think it will be overwhelming Delpo support, but I think it'll feel different. But Djokovic was so good tonight. Nishikori played a really good match was thumped. He was thumped.
I found that a really uplifting performance from Djokovic tonight, because Nishikori threw everything he got at him
and was really good. Somebody tweeted, I think it was Hannah Wilkes, she said, I think it was a set and two sets and 4-2, and she was like, is it weird that my main take home from this match is I'm reminded how good Nishikori is?
Yeah.
And I was feeling the same. I was like, well, obviously Djokovic is brilliant, and yet I'm also thinking about how good Nishikori is, and he's just not in the match.
And how about in the second set when he just suddenly became Pat Rafter? He went to the net like 14 times. And
he's been watching Serena last night, do you
think?
Well,
that's what it felt like, you know, a tactical change. But this was, oh dear, I've got absolutely thumped in the first set by going toe-to-toe with this guy doing what I do, and he's better. So I'm going to have to go to the net. I didn't realise the guy could volley. He was an amazing volley.
Have we ever seen it before?
Maybe he didn't even know he could do it.
It made me wonder. I know that you know, according to the stats, the victory Nishikori had over Djokovic here 4 years ago was an anomaly. He's lost the last 13 matches against Djokovic since then. But it did make me wonder, David. I wasn't here that day. I was back in back home in London. But it's such a bad matchup for Nishikori. Exactly as we saw today, he can play his best. And it's just that bad matchup. It's Ferrer against Nadal, isn't it? It really doesn't matter how well he plays. What happened that day in 2014?
I commentated on that.
He won in straight sets.
And it was, you know how it's at points in this match today, you had those sort of ping pong kind of rallies where they're both standing plumb on the baseline and just teeing off. And they've got both such a sweet ball strike. It's so pure that it just feels like you're watching a computer game going on. My recollection of that match, and I haven't looked at it since, I haven't watched it, I haven't looked at the stats, but my recollection of it is that we had a lot of that, and Djokovic was just a bit off. And I think, to be honest, he might have even taken him a little bit lightly. Because, look, 13 wins in a row since then, I think that will never be forgotten for Djokovic that happened. But on that particular day, bear in mind that I think the third set was 7-6 Nishikori, and that's where the match was decided, really. You know, because it was one set all. He wins the tiebreak.
It wasn't straight sets, right?
It was four sets. Djokovic won a 6-1 set in the second set.
It was the Cilic-Federer that was straight sets, wasn't
it?
That was the astonishing one. Yeah,
that's right. So
it's a 2014 reminiscer package.
It is, yeah.
David doesn't want to think about Cilic and Nishikori ever again.
No, that one wasn't one of my personal highlights of my life as a tennis watcher. Incidentally, Simon Briggs has just texted me and he said, actually, could you make a correction on my behalf? Novak dropped two sets, one in each of his first two rounds. Because we were talking about the run he's had. And of course,
Fucsovics, who was...
It was Tennis Sangren is the one we remembered.
Sangren. And that was the one where he was furious at himself, wasn't he? Absolutely furious, because that was a night session match. The conditions weren't quite as punishing as against Fucsovics.
Yeah.
And he was...
He looked out on his feet. He looked done. I think I tweeted at the time, he's in real trouble, Djokovic, here, and he's vulnerable against Fucsovics. In that second set, couldn't see how he could recover.
It was the Tweety Pie face, wasn't it? The out for the, you know, the stars going around the head.
And today, I don't think I can imagine looking at a more focused, present player than Djokovic was today. There was nothing getting in the way of him today.
Who's going to win then, David?
I'll go Djokovic. I'm so full of it. I said Nadal would win the tournament. I said Del Potro all the way through has looked the best. Now I'm saying Djokovic. Let me sleep on this. I'm going to come back tomorrow and decide what I'm going to go for.
Oh, and I can't protest because it's his birthday.
Is it still? Oh, just yeah, I've got 24 minutes to go.
Just about. Okay, who's winning the women's final?
Right.
Have you already done this with Simon?
No, I haven't.
Because you can't have one prediction for each segment of the show.
What am I going to go for?
Jimmy Connors thinks Osaka.
I'm going to go for Serena Williams. Yeah, I'm going to go for Serena. But I don't feel emphatic about it at all. Do you know what I was saying yesterday about how it seems to me that Sasha Bayen and their training regime has got Osaka behind every ball with this ability to move? That's the bit that makes me really doubt Serena winning this, because the woman is such a good mover and she's so good at getting behind the ball, and that is the key to extending rallies that you wouldn't otherwise be able to figure in.
I feel the same just about Serena, but with not huge amounts of conviction. And I hope I'm not just falling for the fairy tale story. And I think, you know, I didn't do that in Wimbledon, and it was almost even more irresistible than Wimbledon. I am genuinely convinced by her level of play. Her level of play is good enough to win the US Open. Yeah. It's just that Osaka might be even better.
You're right.
Tomorrow.
I mean, actually, Serena is playing close to her peak.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
A little like Djokovic. And well, let's go back to the default. Serena Williams' best is the best. And she's playing way better than she was at Wimbledon. So, yeah, Serena will win the title.
I'm going Serena and Delpo.
Okay. All right.
But even though I think science says Djokovic, but science told me Nadal. And so anti-science has got me this far.
Get lost, science. Anyway, so that's what's coming up. It's mixed doubles final tomorrow at 12 o'clock local time, so 5 p.m. UK. That'll be on Amazon Prime, won't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, presented by me. Thanks, Jamie and Bethany. I'll be getting out of bed early for that.
Oh, dear.
I don't mean to sound quite so resentful. I'm very much looking forward to it. I just wish it could start at 6 p.m.
Yes. Shame that. Oh, well. That's what happens in this tennis world. And then after that, it is the women's singles final from 4 p.m. local time, 9 p.m. UK. Again, that will be on Amazon Prime. We'll be commentating on it as well on BBC Five Live Sports Extra. And incidentally, at 10 o'clock, so an hour later, when the football finishes, they've ditched 6:06, the phone-in show, so that Five Live will be coming straight to the tennis.
I'm so pleased about that.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool.
I mean, 6:06 is enjoyable a lot of the time, but right call.
Yeah, very
the
right call.
Well done,
really
Five Live.
Yeah, so that's cool. So, Catherine will be back tomorrow. I'll be back tomorrow. We'll have a podcast afterwards and all that as well. We've been produced in association with The Telegraph and sponsored by Amazon Prime and the Manga Club. And our executive producers are Melanie Bose and Triple S and TennisBalls.com. And our mascot is Charlie the Ferret. And I'm going to drink this beer, that champagne, and eat those chocolates. See you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.